Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio and the Average White Band with Got the Love. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. The war on terror has directly affected millions of people throughout the Middle East and Central Asia, Europe, and here at home in the United States. Unfortunately, it shows no sign of ending soon. Today, we'll have two perspectives on war. Reverend Susan Turley, a chaplain at the Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System, will talk about her son, Keith Jesse Moore, who died in Iraq, and how she is reaching out to other bereaved mothers. We'll also talk to former U.S. Marine Captain Tyler Boudreau, who appeared on Raising Sand Radio in the early part of this year discussing his book. Today, Tyler Boudreau will talk about how he is rewiring his brain after combat. Reverend Susan Turley is a board-certified chaplain of the National Association of Veterans Affairs and presently directs the Clinical Pastoral Education Program at the Department of Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System. She earned her Masters of Divinity from the Swedenborg School of Religion and was one of the first women to be ordained into the ministry of the Swedenborgian Church. Reverend Turley also holds a Master's of Education in Counseling from Suffolk University and is a graduate of the Boston Family Institute. She is also the mother of Keith Jesse Moore, who died in Yusufaya, Iraq in 2006, and most recently is a filmmaker reaching out to other bereaved mothers. I began our interview by asking Reverend Turley what it is a VA chaplain actually does.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful question. Chaplains at the VA in Palo Alto do a variety of things. Our primary purpose is to provide services, spiritual care to our patients and their families, as well as the staff. And that can involve a bedside visit, one-on-one talking. That can involve offering the rites and sacraments. Making appropriate referrals if a patient has their own pastor they want to visit from, doing end-of-life care, helping people make some difficult decisions, providing support as they go through surgeries, pre-op and post-op. So we do a variety of functions. Our main focus is to be present and provide that loving, caring energy and support to any patient that would like it. And we don't provide any or offer any services that they've already told us they're not interested in or don't want. So it's all about meeting the patient, finding out what their background is, if they're interested in any services, and how we can provide that for them in the best way.
So a patient comes in, say, with polytrauma. Mm-hmm. And they've had some care elsewhere. They end up here. And how do you approach them? Mm-hmm. When do you approach them? How do you do that?
Usually what a chaplain will do is to get some background on the patient first, if at all possible, but we're prepared to make blind visits as well. And we all have our different rotations. We try to see a new admit within 24 hours to be able to let that person know that we're available to them if they would like to use our services. So mainly it's going, usually I check in with the medical staff, whatever nurse is there, just to find out how that patient's day has gone so far, or if there's been anything that's happened on the floor that might be important to know about. Sometimes patients know when another patient has either come in or has passed on. So, and then I just go to the patient's bedside if they're not having some medical procedure done, and introduce myself and talk to them about who we are and what we offer. And if they're willing to share and talk, then I listen and hear about their background and what they've been through and how they're feeling about their condition and their hopes and dreams. And
can you give us an example of a recent visit that you had, a recent new admittee?
For example, we do what we call spiritual assessments with a new patient if they agree to it. And a spiritual assessment is essentially a list of questions that we seek the answers for in the context of a dialogue with the patient. So things like if they have a faith community that they're a member of and would like to be contacted, if they have particular spiritual rituals like prayer or meditation or expressive arts that they would like to do with us as a way to keep their spirits up and strong, or sacred readings or traditions they might like us to bring in and discuss with them. So it's like an interview essentially to get to know what their needs are, and in the midst of that we hope that we'll build rapport and trust with the patient. They'll learn about us and we'll learn about them, and we've developed a healing relationship with them, so that when we return for more visits, you know, they know us and they feel that much more comfortable, and they can begin to talk about some of the things that they're facing now, some of the struggles they might be going through, whether it's family or health or spiritual life, their religious life. So,
and you work with the range of veterans from, say, back to mm-hmm. Korea and Vietnam mm-hmm. all the way?
Yep, and any veteran that is served by this institution, chaplains will go see.
There's also there are also chaplains that work on the bases. Mm-hmm. How is that different?
Well, I think probably they could speak better about that than I could, but I would imagine that bases are, you have the family right there, and you have more access to the daily living of the family.
Actually, I was thinking more about the bases in the combat zones.
Oh, yeah, over in our combat zones. Well, yes, that really is something. I've had a military chaplains in my clinical pastoral education program, and that's a very intensive program that I run here, and so I hear a lot of their stories. But certainly they're on the front lines. They're with the soldiers day in and day out, and are there for them on a daily basis, so they see the results of the war directly, whether it's a spiritual crisis or depression or loneliness or wounds or, you know, battle fatigue and so forth, PTSD. And so they're surrounded by that in that very intense, concentrated, extended periods of time. And I'm sure that has a tremendous effect on them as well.
I did some counseling with the GIs at one point, mostly people that were having second thoughts about going. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, they said the chaplains were extremely helpful. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, the chaplains really just wanted to encourage them to stay in. And so I got the sense that there was a real range of ways that different chaplains deal with the troops themselves.
Mm-hmm. Overseas or
overseas,
at home.
Yeah, and with the fellows that are, with the young people that are saying that, you know, I've really kind of changed my mind about going mm-hmm. into the military, and you know, how do I get out?
how do I
get support?
Yeah, well, from my point of view, chaplains are supposed to be a place where soldiers and veterans can come and have a certain level of confidentiality and ability to express whatever they need to express without being influenced one way or the other, except for towards health and well-being and spiritual well-being. So I'm not quite sure what would motivate a chaplain to try to sway a person to leave or stay. Maybe it's, I don't even want to try to guess, but I do know there are consequences of leaving. But I think you've heard, I've got this video called Soldiers of Conscience, and it is about soldiers that have left the military, left the army, and the consequences that they're suffering right now because of it. And that addresses some of the roles of the chaplains in that. But it's an excellent film.
Well, you also have a film. Let's talk about your film.
Okay. My film is called Broken Hearts, Lifted Spirits. And it's a film about the impact of losing one's child on a mother's faith journey. And I've just completed it. We're in our very last tweakings of things, and then it'll be ready to be distributed. But I have screened it on about three occasions now. I went to four different areas of the country and interviewed focus groups. They were all women who had lost one of their children over in Iraq or Afghanistan. And they are self-identified Christians. And so they're not only women of faith, but they're also, and women that are bereaved, but they're also women that were willing to talk about it and be filmed. And courageous, articulate, just amazing women that I admire and identify with so much, of course, having lost my son in Iraq.
Well, let's talk about that. Describe what had happened with your son. Your son is Keith Jesse Moore.
Keith Jesse Moore, yes.
And he was 27.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in Yusufaya?
Yes.
Yusufaya, Iraq.
Uh-huh, yeah. He was at a checkpoint. Keith had decided to join the military as a way to serve his country.
How old was he at the time?
He was 27.
When he went in?
Yes. And he died 8 months later. So he had, out of his entire 27 years, 8 months with the military. But he had told me before he deployed that while he knew this war was controversial and he had mixed feelings about it himself, once he joined the military, he was at the beck and call, so to speak, of the civilian population through the government, and he was very happy about the potential of serving his country in that way, and then he wanted to do his stint in the military and then return to the university to study physics again and become a physicist, which was always his first love.
He left Fort Benning in February 2006,
mm-hmm.
and then he was deployed to Iraq.
We actually left August. San Francisco February 14th to go to Fort Benning for basic and advanced training.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh. And then graduated in June, and then they stationed him at Fort Drum in New York, 10th Mountain Infantry. So he was there and negotiated with the people in charge to be deployed to Iraq earlier than his own unit. Actually, they scatter the units, so the soldiers don't even necessarily go over with those that they trained. And he went over with a whole different battalion and company and unit and so forth of complete strangers because he wanted to go and do his job. He didn't want to hang out on the base and wait until September. So he left in August with a group of soldiers and got to Kuwait, and they stayed there for a while, and then he went to Iraq, and his job was basically manning a checkpoint out in southern Iraq, out in the middle of the desert or the country or something. There was not much there at all. And rotated, evidently, from three positions, one actually doing the pat-down at the checkpoint, two observing that, and three being out in the Humvee, watching for snipers. So that was their three positions that they did, I think, about 8 days in a row, and then came back to the base and cleaned up and then went back out again.
Were you in touch with him during this period?
I was, yeah. We got email, and every once in a while he was able to call, and I was able to talk to him on the phone. Yeah.
And how was he doing?
Well, I think he was trying to maintain a very positive attitude, being the new kid on the block, even though he was older than a lot of the soldiers. I think he, had to put up with a lot of however they treat, you know, new soldiers. But he befriended the doctor. Doc Cunningham was a great friend of his. He was in his 30s, so they had a lot more in common than some of the younger kids. And I think he was disappointed. I think that manning a checkpoint out in the middle of the sandbox is one of the most boring, tedious jobs. And I think he was very, very disappointed that he didn't have a more active job to do. So I think boredom was one of the, and also he started, he was worried about his relationship with his girlfriend. He had reunited with his high school sweetheart after 10 years of being apart, really wanted to marry her. She wasn't, she's very ambivalent about becoming a military wife, and so he became more and more despondent about losing her. And he also evidently wasn't sleeping well, and I could tell through his emails and some of his phone calls that he didn't seem like he was very, you know, happy. There was a deterioration going on of his mind and spirit.
Did he recognize that? Was he able to?
Well, I would ask him how he was doing, and he always kept up a stiff upper lip and said, "I'm fine, Mom, don't worry about me, I'm fine." You know, yeah, I'm talking to people about stuff, and I'm okay. But he's, and that's how young boys are. You know, they don't want their moms to worry. So I wasn't quite sure whether I was accurate in my assessment of his state of being. Mother's intuition, and you listen to what they say, but it was confusing, to say the least, about.
So what happened?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what happened. After he died, it took over a year to get the investigative reports, but supposedly what happened the day that he died is that he had a dispute with the officer in charge about the pat-down protocol. And I think he didn't, being a person who respected his elders, especially women and children, I think he just found it difficult to pat down Muslim women and children. I'm just putting pieces together. I'm not sure exactly what happened. But he was not acting himself. He got extremely agitated and was sent back to the previous position, which was the Humvee, watching for snipers, and on the way back he shot himself. So
was anyone with him when that?
There's only two other soldiers at the checkpoint, so it was just the three of them. And that's what they said happened. Any other information is very sketchy. I haven't been able to talk to anybody who was there. I've only been in communication, and that stopped once the investigation was over, with the investigating officers, and that was through email. I've never had a face-to-face conversation with anybody that was over there at the time. I've tried innumerable ways, but I just don't know really what did happen.
When you heard the news, and here you are working in the hospital with so many veterans, mm-hmm. How was that for you?
Well, it's been 2.5 years, so it's different now than it was the first few days, weeks, months, and year.
Did someone come and in person tell you what had happened?
My husband and I were at home, and so the officers came to our apartment. I was living in an apartment then. Like all other mothers, I wouldn't let him in. As soon as the doorbell rang, I had this awful feeling. And I looked out the door, and there they were, and I told them to go away. And at any rate, they did finally talk me into letting them in, they told me, and it was the worst day of my life. It's been horrible. And it continues to be horrible. I miss my son. And what I have come to say now at this young period of my grief is that it doesn't get better. That's a myth. What it gets different because I learn how to manage my grief better. I suppose you can say better. I can anticipate when times are going to be especially rough for myself and my family around the holidays, his birthday, his death date, and so forth. And so I'm learning to prepare and manage it better. So that's something. And working here has been both the difficult and the best thing for me. I've had many, many military personnel talk to me about how sorry they are, and have talked about what it's like for them to lose a buddy or part of their unit to suicide, and how they consider it another casualty of war. There isn't a lot of judgment about it. So I've received tremendous support and love and from military personnel as well as people here at the hospital. Working with the young men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan is also a mixed blessing. I love to work with them and to see them, and at the same time it can trigger my grief, and so I learn to manage that. But it's like any environment, but I wouldn't be anywhere else right now. So
the thing that is really clear to me is that the bereaved parents have something very, very important to share with the rest of us about being human in that way, kind of deepening your humanity through the experiences that you have of your children dying at such a young age. Mm-hmm. And so I always think of them in some way as a national treasure. Mm-hmm. And I think that you have taken that that experience and you're trying to turn it into something that the citizens of this country can look at and understand more about. Mm-hmm. War and more about the experiences that you've had. And talk a little more about that movie and some of the parents that you've you mentioned earlier.
Yes, the film is very powerful because the women are so honest and fully present with tremendous vulnerability and integrity. So you cannot listen to their stories without your heart just breaking open. And the last time I showed the film, I had many people come forward and to talk with me about how the film gave them permission to feel things about previous losses that they could not feel for decades.
Previous losses in
their own life.
In the military or in their
Both civilians and military. It's just touching for anyone, and that's probably 100% of us that have lost a significant other will relate and find comfort from this film. It's also disturbing as well because it's, the as you said, the loss of our national treasure, our young people. But I think what I wanted to achieve was giving a way to honor the memory of our children in a way that would be useful for other people in terms of learning how to be with the bereaved. So it was twofold. And so the film is not only a moving documentary, but it's also an educational film where any facilitator can show it to any group of people who have a sincere interest in being able to learn how to journey with the bereaved in a effective way, can use this film. It has three sections to it with three different focuses for group discussion and further study and training in bereavement work. So it has that twofold purpose. And also I wanted the experience of gathering the women together to be healing. And I prayed to God. I said, if this process of doing this project is not going to be a positive healing experience for the participants who volunteer to be a part of it, I don't want to do it. Because that's the most important thing to me, is that we gather together to honor and remember our daughters and our sons. We provide support to each other and tell our stories. And there's a truth that emerges when you've gone through a crisis. There's the people's ability to be real and honest is just somehow breaks through all the facades when there's a tragedy. And I wanted to be in that sphere and have my film capture that. So, because I find that the thing that I do draw comfort from is the truth. And I'm not talking about doctrinal or biblical truths that we argue about. I'm talking about truths of the heart, the type of feelings and thoughts and struggles that we go through when there's been a death that seems, well, that was preventable, whose cause and purpose is ambivalent in the least. And it's just out of the normal life cycle. It's just tragic. And there's just no way of reframing that. And so how does a human being deal with the kind of tragedies that we see all over planet Earth that many Americans are just not directly touched by? The famines, the tribal wars, the starvations and so forth, just pointless, preventable deaths of our young, precious people, as well as our elders and everything in between. So
it does seem as though there's an ability to push away these kinds of things very easily in the United States, and that somehow grappling with them or bringing them forward is sometimes you're not thanked for that kind of work. Have you found that to be true with your film?
What I've found, well, it's an interesting point you make. It's quite a range. As I've said, I've found people that have come forward to me with tears, with tremendous gratitude because their hearts have been opened in a variety of different ways. And I think any time a human being's heart is opened, then it expands your world and you're just better off for it, despite the pain that it brings with as well. I have found people, I mean, we all have tolerances of how much truth we can handle in any given moment, you know, including you and me. And so I try not to be too judgmental of people that turn away. But, you know, frankly, my experience has been to date with this film is that people just want to flock to me and just love me. And those that don't do that, I don't know, because they don't talk to me and I don't know what's going on with them. Maybe they have to go and think about it and reflect about it, and their response time is different. It's a different path. But it's hard for people to, including myself, to be constantly focused on the tragedies on planet Earth. And I think balance is important. And that balance is not fixed, and so it's always moving. Yeah. You know, my feeling is that if you focus on an issue that really moves your heart long enough, you're going to be compelled to do something, to respond somehow. And when that response gets frustrated, then it's difficult to stay focused on it.
But there's also something freeing, isn't there, in being able to look at this clearly, at least, you know, 50% of the time. As you say, you can't stay focused on this all the time, but to actually understand what's going on, and that it's somehow, if we were talking about famines or that these things are within our ability to change, and that becomes freeing if you engage fully with it.
I think so. I think it's the lack of ability to respond in a positive way that is so debilitating. And we do have limitations, whether it's money or opportunity or resources, and so that frustrates our ability to respond, or confidence or attitude or health, whatever. But it is freeing to know the truth as little as we see, and hopefully it'll be a motivating factor to do something. But I have learned to pick something to focus on, and right now in my life, right now, I'm focusing on Mothers of the Fallen, bereavement, and that kind of thing. And doing this film is how I've responded, and that has given me a sense of, it's a way that I've dealt with my own grief. It's given me a sense of hope, of purpose, of direction.
When the people that you deal with, the veterans that you deal with here at the VA, do they know your history when you talk with them, or?
Well, if they ask me, I will tell them the truth. And I have consulted with the medical staff about how's the best way to share my story with patients when they ask. I think every staff member has differing opinions and so forth, depending on the condition of the patient. But I have revealed that information to Vietnam veterans who have asked me. Sometimes they know. They find out somehow. And their response is always so much compassion. And with the soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, when they've found out, the ones that I've been ministering to have various levels of brain injuries and other injuries, and so I want to be sure that I'm not adding to their difficulties and struggles in their recovery process. But sometimes it brings us closer together because now there's an instant rapport and trust. You know, I had a son over there. I lost a son. Sometimes they want to adopt me and I want to adopt them. There's a lot of love going on there, you know, and they're just so very kind. But I'm not a stranger to the war. And that brings us closer together.
That was Reverend Susan Turley, a chaplain in the Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System, whose son Keith Jesse Moore died in Yusufaya in Iraq in 2006. We'll have Reverend Turley back on the show to share excerpts from her film, and I'm really looking forward to sharing that with you. The Who from the album Who's Next with Going Mobile to introduce our next segment with former U.S. Marine Captain Tyler Boudreau. Tyler Boudreau appeared on Raising San Radio in the early part of this year talking about his book Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. You can listen to that interview archived on our website, raisingsandradio.org. These days, Tyler Boudreau is taking a unique route to healing himself from war, and I interviewed him by cell phone on the road in Helena, Montana, and asked him to describe this unique route.
What I'm doing is I'm riding my bicycle across the country. I'm starting in Seattle, and I'm going to my hometown in Massachusetts. And I'm doing this for a couple of reasons. The first is it's sort of a twofold project. One is for sort of individual processing of my experiences in Iraq, and the second is for sort of community gatherings and discussions along the way about war and about post-traumatic stress and about all of the issues that kind of relate to those things.
I want to know more about how it is to be processing your experiences from Iraq on a bicycle ride.
Well, the way it kind of came out is I wanted to do something that was, there was a physical challenge. And I think that what happens when people leave the military is that they lose a part of their identity, which is, you know, very much attached to physical challenges, you know, so whether it be tough training or even some sort of, war experience or whatever. Sort of a great deal of the value that they invest in themselves is being able to do these, great physical feats. And then they come home, and there are no great physical feats to accomplish anymore. And, of course, they can go exercise, but that doesn't have quite the same value. And I think that can be, in its own way, discouraging. So that just sort of adds to whatever turmoil they're having, emotional problems they're having about the experience of war. So I wanted to start from there and make some, you know, challenge for myself that was, you know, larger than life for me. And for me, it would be riding a bike across the country because I'm not a cyclist.
You've never been much of a cyclist?
And so I, you know, got myself a bike, learned a couple of things, and started riding. Well, also, there's the obvious connection between exercise and mental health. I mean, anybody who exercises know that it's, you know, it feels good and it makes you feel good. So there's that. And then that brings you into the kind of the mental health portion of it. And I wanted to spend some time, reflecting on the war experience and on my time in the military and my relationship to society and sort of and how things have come about. But there was also something else on the individual side. When I did start to get back into the gym, because I came back from Iraq and I had a very difficult time getting back into exercise. I'd always been in very good shape, but I came home from Iraq and I had a difficult time getting into the gym. And periodically I would get into the gym for a little stretches of time, and as I started to get stronger, I noticed this curious phenomenon of kind of a growing aggression building up inside of me. So I'd finish working out and I'd walk out of the gym and I'd feel this kind of aggressive emotion like towards people, and it was sort of unexplainable. It didn't really make any sense. And what I kind of put together for me was that I had been in the Marine Corps for a good deal of time, for about 12 years, since the time I was 17 until 34. Exercise had always been connected to making myself a fighter, always. That's always the connection that it had been for me. Mm. And so now I'm, you know, going to the gym and I have no intention or no reason and no desire to be a fighter. And yet I'm feeling those feelings. So I really wanted to create some kind of situation where I was able to exercise, because exercise is a good thing, and not have that feeling connected. So, which is kind of one of the reasons that I designed the trip to start away from home and always heading home, so that every revolution of my pedals, every ounce of energy, mental and physical, was concentrated on this task of getting home to my family. And it's actually worked tremendously well. As I improve in my fitness here and I'm getting stronger in my legs and, you know, I'm able to handle more miles, I don't have any of that kind of aggressive feeling going on. It's all connected with getting home, and it's a very positive thing. So all of those combined, those issues combined, kind of make for the individual sort of elements of my trip.
You're rewiring your brain.
Yeah. I find that, you know, it sort of occurred to me that, well, you know, in the military, they do quite a lot of conditioning of the brain for their purposes, and it seems to me that I can condition the brain for my purposes. I don't have to depend on this just because I've done this for a lot of years. I don't have to stay this way. I can sort of, you know, direct myself the way I want to go, and so that's kind of what I'm doing on an individual basis.
And along the way, you're having other people cycle with you.
That's right. So I have had other cyclists, veterans and non-veterans, who have kind of come with me for portions of the trip. Right now I'm alone, and I'll be sort of picking up some riders, I think, in North Dakota, and then some others in Wisconsin, and, you know, sort of periodically picking up riders, and then there'll be periods of time where I'm alone. But then all along this ride, there are visits with communities, and we have discussions, or we talk about my book, Packing Inferno, et cetera.
Yeah. Share some of what you're learning or some of what you're sharing with these folks in these kinds of gatherings.
Well, one of the main things that I try to present to people is kind of a way to have this conversation about war. And the reason that I'm very interested in the approach to the conversation itself, you know, as opposed to, say, the conclusion to the conversation, is because what I noticed as a returning veteran, you know, who was having some, you know, struggles with the war experience, that there was really no place for me to kind of express that, because the conversation back home was so fired up and so black and white, and either you were for the war or you're against the war. And the veteran coming home who's struggling with identity, with, you know, a military culture, with a warrior culture, with some things that he might say, he doesn't like, feels that there's some immoral stuff going on, but then again, on the other hand, might feel positive about other portions. I mean, it's confusing, it's complex. As all issues are complex, but you don't get a sense of that complexity from the popular debate on war. And so what happens is that veteran who's struggling with these issues winds up sort of stuck with no place to go, with no place to, you know, express these ambiguous feelings, no place to work them out, and winds up either, well, I mean, in some cases can go find a community that matches, as close as possible, you know, his kind of perspectives on the war. Or if he doesn't have that option, like, goes home to hometown, and that's just, it is what it is. So to make a more tangible example, if someone comes home and they're unhappy about the way the war has gone and don't feel like it's a good idea anymore, but they go home to a community that's, you know, extremely pro-war, it makes it very difficult for them to express some of those consternations. I mean, it's just, you know, there's nobody wants to hear it. And if those things are tied to post-traumatic stress, it makes it really difficult. So I think you get what I'm saying with that.
Yeah.
Why I'm interested in the mode of conversation. So what I do is I always orient on my experience when I talk about Iraq, rather than starting out from, say, a political perspective. And the way this came about is whenever I was talking about my book, I always sort of introduce myself and say, well, you know, this is who I am, and this is where I come from, and sort of how I came to be where I am today. And what I noticed in the audiences was, as I'm telling my story, you know, whatever hardened or skeptical faces I saw would start to melt into a, you know, sort of a curiosity. And they'd be like, oh, okay, so let me hear about this guy's story. And sooner or later, you'd kind of see that they had stepped into my life with me and were sort of traveling along with me. And so they could better understand and relate to, you know, the concerns that I had along the way and the dilemmas that I faced. So now whether or not they agreed with me at the end of the discussion or not was almost irrelevant to me, because at that point I felt that there was some real value in the conversation itself. Like, we could really exchange ideas as opposed to just exchanging rhetoric and exchanging anger. Mm-hmm. So what I started doing is really kind of focusing on this and sort of saying, like, this is the way the conversation ought to be in a lot of places. Orient yourself on your experience as a person. And that person will orient on their experience as a person. You will find so much more of your experiences intertwined than you will your sort of your political views. You know, because if you start out with that, if you start out with the banner, like, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican, the conversation is closed from the start.
Right.
And so that's really been kind of the main thing for me, and just kind of, you know, yes, I have points to make, and yes, I have opinions on the war, and I'm not shy about sharing those opinions, but that's not what I focus on. I focus on how do I present the opinion that I have, and how can you present the opinion you have, and how can we have a good conversation about it, and still actually, you know, be in the same room together and you know, and not mind each other's company.
Yeah, I mean, what you're trying to do here is something that has certainly been lacking in the last 8 years, I think, but is the most enriching thing about being in conversation with another person, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I sort of picked up little pieces of evidence of this along the way. You know, like I said, at first just telling my story about the book, but even before that, I can look back and say, you know, when I first, my first sort of iteration of my book was not what it is today. It was just this sort of cold analysis of my experience. And I make all the same conclusions in Packing Inferno that I did in my analysis, but there was no mood to it. There was no personality to it, and there was no I in it. I wasn't in the story. But as soon as I put myself into the story, made this thing about, you know, a human life, well, then all of a sudden there was a lot of interest. Oh, wow, I'm really relating to this story. I can understand, and wow, it's amazing. because people want to hear about someone's life and story that they can relate to. You know, as soon as you, you know, kind of dehumanize it, you know, and put it into these kind of like hardened political terms, well, then people just, that's what you get. You get a hardened political response.
Yeah, I mean, you're completely right. But what I'm really struck by, Tyler, is the sensitivity that you have now to your own inner experience. Is this something new? I mean, a sensitivity to read what's going on in your inner being. Have you always had that?
I don't know about the always part, but I definitely, you know what you're saying and recognize it for sure. And it's something that I have, I found great value in, like, you know, hardcore introspection. And what I say to anybody is, when, if you want to talk about war, or really any other issue, but, you know, since I happen to be kind of in the realm of war, I say, if you want to talk about war, the first thing you need to do is have a conversation with yourself. You need to get into the mirror, and you need to have a hardcore conversation with yourself. Why do I feel the way I feel? Why do I say the things I think? What led me to the place I am? And, you know, you kind of inventory your whole experience from whatever point, from childhood or last year or whatever it is, and you really kind of say, what are all the things that influence the way I might think or react? And you have to do it with yourself, first of all, because you're the only one that can know these things inside you. But also, I think it's valuable to start by yourself, because you might come up with some things that are embarrassing or humiliating or things you're not so proud of. But you know what? If you don't include those, you know, in the inventory, you're not going to come up with a truthful answer. It's not going to happen. You've got to be hardcore honest with yourself and say, what really, really, what is this all about? What am I all about? And then what happens is you can come up with so many answers, like, oh, okay, now I'm really starting to get the picture here. Now, just based on my understanding of myself, I can start to see a little bit more about what's happening in other people, and you start to learn how to, how do I say it? It's important to figure these things without judgment, and this is kind of a crucial portion of this. I don't look back and say, you know, what a terrible person I did because I did these things in Iraq. That's not a useful analysis of yourself. You may have judgments at the end. There may be things you want to change about yourself, or, you know, you want to take a new direction. But you don't want to sit there and sit in judgment of yourself, because what that usually does is it usually creates this block, some sort of barrier within yourself. You just kind of block it out, and you're like, oh, I don't want to talk about that. That's embarrassing, or that's bad.
Well, I mean, how do you do that if you're not really used to doing that, and if there's very little in your environment that is encouraging you to do that? I'm fascinated with how you found value in that, you know, that way of conversing with yourself, where you refuse to let shame and all of these negative emotions crowd out your actual interrogation.
You know, I can tell you about how the process sort of, you know, how the snowball started for me. I don't know how exactly to prescribe someone else, but for me, it actually started in a tactical environment, because, you know, maybe I'm sort of an analytical person anyway. I don't know if that's sort of part of my makeup, but, you know, one of the things that bothered me about Iraq was, you know, I mean, I was an infantry officer, and we're paying very close to our orders and our missions and our operations and how they related to each other. I mean, I was looking on a tactical level for effectiveness. And so the conclusions and the criticisms that I have for Iraq were based on my infantry sensibilities. They weren't, you know, I wasn't as though I, you know, came up and suddenly became this very humane person. It was like, oh, this is terrible, this is immoral. You know, later on, I sort of started to look at the morality and the legality, et cetera, of the war. But that's not how it all started. It started as an infantry assessment. And I just, based on that, said, this isn't exactly effective. That's the first thing I noticed, because we were here for stability. It said here in our mission statement that we're supposed to stabilize this region and you know, lower insurgent activity. And, in fact, we got into more and more fights. And there was an escalation of animosity like you can't believe. I mean, obviously the Iraqi people in the area were getting pretty angry, clearly, because they kept on shooting at us and bombing us and stuff. And then we, of course, were getting angry for taking casualties, et cetera. And so, you know, it would just sort of build and build and build. And we had all these fights going on. And I'm staring at this mission statement going, wait a second here. So that's the first thing I noticed. And the second thing I noticed is that nobody else was noticing. And that really started to bother me. And at that point, that's when I started saying, okay, hold on a second here. Why is it that Tyler Booth was the only person noticing this? Because I'm definitely not the smartest guy around. There's a lot of really smart guys around, you know, in the military, above the military, you know, all these people can see what I can see, and yet people aren't noticing. Why is that? So that begins the process of peeling back. And as I start to peel back, I can't get myself out of that process. I can't peel back the military and not peel back myself. So I start peeling back myself because I am the military. I was a military man. That's my career. I was a long time in the Marine Corps. And I have to, in order for me to answer some of these questions, why do they do what they do? I have to say, why do I do what I do? And, you know, you can see how the process starts to unfold from there.
This is, it's really great to hear you speaking this way. I think that, are you finding that there are people in your former military personnel in your position, you were a captain, doing similar things that have now departed the military?
I don't know for sure. Okay. I mean, I certainly know that there are a lot of veterans who have left, and some have become critical of the war, and they're sort of looking at things in their own way. I'm not sure. I don't specifically know of anybody who's sort of using introspection as their, like, kind of main mode. Uh-huh. Many, I think the most popular mode is to kind of really, like, analyze the political situation and try to understand the military situation and the strategic situation. And I think that those are, you know, useful things, too. I don't think that those should be ignored or dismissed, but I think that the individual experience is fundamental. It's foundational to the whole thing. And I'm not really that well informed on politics and history. I mean, I know a few things. I've read a couple of books. But what I'm saying is that the average, you know, individual who is like me, who kind of reads a little bit but is not a scholar, does not need necessarily to be a scholar to judge the war, because what happens is that you look at the presentation from the political leaders, presidents, or whoever, and you overlay the experience of the individual soldier, and you say, okay, based on what I've sort of understood about my own experience, which is, for me, it was an infantryman in the warrior culture, trained for combat, put in a situation like Iraq where he doesn't know who's friendly and who's not friendly, he's going to wind up acting hostily. That's how it's going to go. And, you know, it's sort of inevitable. This is human nature. There really isn't any other way to behave when your life is in danger. And you've been trained in a certain way and you're in a certain culture, that's just how it's going to play out. You're going to wind up being aggressive and hostile, and therefore they're going to be more hostile. And, you know, I mean, so I guess what I'm saying here is that you take that knowledge of the human experience and consciousness, et cetera, and you overlay it on whatever policy that's being presented, and you say, it's not possible. Whatever he's saying over there, it's not humanly possible. I don't need to know the history of Iraq or the Middle East or the U.S. or anything else. I can tell you that from a human point of view, this is not going to happen.
Tyler, let's change gears a little. I know that you have you're going to be off soon, but where do you go from here? You started off in Seattle, and you're now in Helena, Montana.
Right.
Where's the next stop?
Okay, so yes, I'm going over to Billings, Montana. Next, I'll be stopping there to do a reading, and then the next stop is Bismarck, North Dakota, and then Fargo, North Dakota. Then I head off into Minnesota and Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania. Oh, excuse me, Indiana's in that too. Sorry, and then New Jersey briefly, New York, and then Connecticut, and home to Massachusetts.
And when do you expect to be home?
I will be home on August 30th, Sunday.
And are you blogging as you go?
I am indeed. TylerBoudreau.com.
tylerboudreau.com. And are you carrying books with you?
You mean my books? Uh-huh. No, I don't. I'm not hauling books with me. Usually, what happens is, either it'll be a reading at a bookstore, or we'll do something about ordering the books. Because you can order the books online from my website or from, one of the other online sellers. But I'm carrying one copy of my own book, and I'm carrying one other book for this trip, and that's a collection of George Orwell's columns from back when he was a newspaper man.
Interesting. And where do you stay at night?
That's a combination of hospitality and under the stars. No hotel rooms on this trip. We're gonna try to force I'm gonna try to force myself on people as much as possible.
Well, I am going to suggest that the listeners go to your blog, tylerboudreau.com. In fact, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to ask you to be with us again briefly next Monday.
It all depends on cell phone reception.
Yeah, of course. Well, I think it's great, and I want to know more about how it pans out, and maybe next week we can talk more about some of the other folks that you're meeting in Montana. Where will you be in Billings? And when again?
On July 14th at 7 p.m., I'll be at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and that's, on the 14th at 7 p.m.
Okay.
And, you can find all the details on the website, tylerboudreau.com,
okay,
and you can
great.
Get there's the blog there, and there's photographs, and there's all sorts of information about the trip.
Okay. Well, thanks for being with us, and we'll talk with you next week.
All right. Thank you.
Stay in touch with Tyler's journey with us here next week. And during the week, you can visit his website, tylerboudreau.com, tylerboudreau.com, to see how the cycling trip across the country is going. And that's our show for today. As usual, all views and opinions expressed are those of the host and guests, and not Stanford University or KZSU. The Who will take us out.
When I'm mobile, wee-hoo, beep, beep, play the tape machine, make the toast and tea. When I'm mobile, well, I can lay in bed with only Howie ahead. When I'm mobile, keep me moving. Taxman miss me, I'm out!